Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
There was a police body cam video from a frat house at the University of Iowa that went viral a couple weeks ago.
You're not bringing this up just because I'm from Iowa, are you?
Well, I did. One of the reasons I was going to do this was because it was about Iowa.
Okay.
Your home country. So the footage
was
from
a country.
Yeah,
just,
well,
by
you
the
know
way,
what I mean.
There's a lot of country out
yeah,
there.
You know what I mean.
Yeah.
The home of black dirt. Iowa.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The good and fertile soil
Very
of Iowa.
Fertile soil. Yeah.
The footage was from November of 2024, and it shows police responding to a fire alarm at a fraternity house, only to find a basement full of pledges about to finish an initiation ritual. As officers ask if anyone is there against their will or injured, all the boys responded in unison with a no. Apparently, they were having some kind of a knockdown, drag-out food fight down there.
Okay, so that sounds fun.
So upon finding out about the incident, the university suspended the fraternity for a violation of hazing policies. When the body cam footage recently became public, it accumulated over 10 million views. Reaction comments included many along the lines of calling this an exercise in a grooming ritual. This exercise was a grooming ritual and training fraternity members to normalize exploitation, hierarchy, and silence. So in response to that, there was an article in the Free Press where the author points out that initiation practices are ancient. Every empire has had them, from the Inuits to the Vikings to the Spartans, and they often involve training, fighting, wilderness survival, and even public floggings. Boys are given manufactured hardship requiring resiliency to withstand the test. These tests serve as bonding experiences with boys emerging as men, grown up and newly bound to their communities. Compare that to today, where many young men are increasingly isolated and glued to a screen playing video games, and they're unable to connect with other men. The author of this piece, by the way, was female, and she points out that we've been so conditioned into safety and safe spaces that she says she's not surprised men go and create unsafe spaces for themselves, especially when they're at an age desperate to test their limits.
Mm-hmm.
She also points out that many women won't relate to how men process things, as she recalls her grandfather's death when her uncle packed her brothers and cousins, who were wound tight from the funeral proceedings, into a truck bed and drove around town letting them set off fireworks as they were going.
Meanwhile,
sounds
like fun.
Yeah, meanwhile, the aunts and nieces sat together in the living room trading stories about her grandfather, watching from the window when the boys returned to stand around and throw bank snaps at each other's ankles. And she says, to each their beautiful own.
That is a wise woman right there.
Yeah. And so, okay, I myself was never in a fraternity in college. I couldn't afford to be in a fraternity. But I totally get this need for the testing, you know, bonding experience for men. And, you know, the problem as I see it is really like the unintended consequences when you have, you know, alcohol or drugs involved.
Sure. So there could certainly be excesses.
Yeah. So, but what are your thoughts generally about these, you know, manufactured hardships which are basically hazing?
Well, hazing is one aspect of it, but there's many other things that have less of a negative connotation. I did youth work for 20 years of my life. I worked primarily with young men, especially those going through that stage of maturing and developing their identity. And you've got to create rites of passage for them. You've got to create opportunities to test themselves, to grow, to expand their capacities, because that's how young men develop confidence. And I think that's because that's missing in our society today. We've got generations of young people who lack confidence, and they crumble in the face of adversity. And it is a real problem for society. And that's why I think all throughout history, as you pointed out at the beginning, there have been these rites of passage, this going through adversity to become a man.
Yeah. What about this bonding experience? I think that's really a central element to it.
Yeah. I mean, if you read Band of Brothers, don't watch that. I mean, the HBO miniseries is good. It's got a couple of raunchy scenes in it. But if you read the book written by Stephen Ambrose, he makes that point precisely at the very beginning of the episode. He says that men bond through adversity. The deepest bonds that men have isn't because they talked about things together. It's because they underwent some sort of adversity, suffering together. The brotherhood of the trenches, he calls it. That is extremely powerful. And the deepest friendship that men can form are through adversity.
Right. And so what do you think about this in relation to women, though? I don't know that the sorority system
very
has...
Very different.
Yeah, so they don't do the same sort
no,
of...
No, and this is where we need to recognize that God has made men and women different, complementary, equal in dignity, but with their real differences. And sometimes, because women tend to have more of a tendency towards egalitarianism, they want to... Part of their feminine genius is to bring people together, inclusive... There's a negative side to that of wanting to equalize everything and ignore the differences that really do exist.
But this author, I think, doesn't do that.
That's why I said it's a really wise woman who has recognized that, yes, there are real differences between men and women. So I think it's important to recognize that those rites of passage for women are different. And the way that they process things is different. Like just the example that you gave, the aunt and the nieces were sitting around talking about it, sharing stories. That's one of the key ways that women bond and they work through things. Most women, not all, but most are external processors where they got to talk through things. And that's beautiful. It's good. I'm listening to the novel by Leo Tolstoy right now in my Audible account and Anna Karenina. It's a phenomenal novel, really insightful into human nature. But he was astute about the differences of human nature. And he talks in different chapters about how the women were bonding, how they're talking about things, how they're processing things, some of the tensions that come up in the marriages in the story because of the different ways that men and women process things. It's a reality. And we ignore those differences to our own peril.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. So did you hear about the tragic story of the high school seniors who toilet papered a teacher's home in Gainesville, Georgia?
No, I did not hear about that.
So I want to compare and contrast the almost ridiculous disparity of the price of a life in different corners of the world. This senior prank, which just happened recently, left a Georgia teacher and father of two dead as 40-year-old Jason Hughes, the teacher at North Hall High School, died while tripping and falling into the road and then accidentally getting run over by one of the fleeing teens as the teacher came out of his house to join in on the fun of the prank that they were toilet papering his house.
Hmm.
So following the teacher's death, the teens were hit with multiple charges, including the driver of the vehicle being charged with first-degree vehicular homicide, where he would face between 3 and 15 years behind bars.
Wow.
This was clearly an accident.
It's a costly prank.
Yes. And ultimately, the Hall County District Attorney dropped the charges after the teacher's wife asked them to be dropped so that they would, quote, prevent a separate tragedy from occurring, ruining the lives of these students,
sure,
unquote. So I want to compare that with a story, a personal story from less than 2 weeks ago from a friend of mine who was on a fishing trip in Cabo San Lucas, Mexico, with a buddy of his who has a place down there. So after a day on the water, they arrived under darkness back to the marina, and due to construction on the normal route back to this guy's place, they were taken on an unfamiliar detour. As they went further down a road that they had never been on before, they weren't sure it was going the right way. And one of the guys, or multiple guys in the car, suggested that they turn back, and the driver, who's my buddy's friend, he agreed and pulled a U-turn, but didn't see the oncoming motorcycle that hit his car broadside going 50 miles an hour.
Oh my gosh.
Now, my buddy's friend, who was the driver, as I said, was completely sober. They tended to the badly hurt motorcyclist. They called the police and an ambulance, okay? And they waited, obviously, for those folks to show up. So after the EMTs and police were on scene, the driver eventually asked the police what he was supposed to do next. In broken English, because it was the only person who spoke in English, an EMT from the ambulance explained, while the police looked on, that he needed to pay $3,000 to the motorcyclist for a new motorcycle.
Hmm.
The guy was alive, by the way, but badly hurt.
Thanks be to God.
So not knowing the ultimate fate of the injured man, the ambulance and police left them there after he forked over the money, and that was the end of the matter as far as the Mexican police were concerned.
Right.
Nobody knows what happened to the guy. Okay, so I bring up these two extremes in dealing with accidental death. So in the first case, I think it was ridiculous for the DA to ever bring charges on what everyone agreed was a harmless prank that turned tragic. Versus the second one, where we don't know if the guy died. Hopefully he did not. But at the very least, he was seriously injured, and how cavalier and, you know, unconcerned the authorities involved seem to be. So what are your thoughts?
Well, I would take a little bit different take on that, their approach to paying the $3,000. I mean, they're looking at it a very practical way. It's like, hey, this was the guy's way of getting around, his livelihood probably for his family. So, you know, fix that, and then, you know, he'll get better, and, you know, we'll work that out. So it was a very practical approach. The American approach is very litigious. It's like, let's sue him, and or let's get him into prison. So it's a different mindset. I mean, I just came back from Mexico on Sunday myself. I was down there for a mission trip in Cuatro Ciénegas, and I've been down to Mexico many times for mission trips and spent a lot of my time in my formation for the priesthood studying with people from all across Latin America. So I've understood from within a little bit more of the mentality and contrast it with the American mentality. So it's not a question of valuing life less or putting a price tag on it. It's just like, hey, let's solve this practically. You know, we don't gain anything by sending you to jail for, you know, making a U-turn. Just fix the guy's life and get his life back in order as best you can. And let's all move on and be happy.
Yeah, but it wasn't even that. It was pay for the motorcycle. Like, don't pay for the guy's medical bills. I don't even know if health care is free in Mexico or not. But, you know,
there's limited health care that you can get.
At the very least, though, whatever this guy, even if the initial health care was going to be free, he's going to need, you know, some rehab, and there's going to be some costs down the road. And he certainly is going to be
that's the American mentality again.
Yeah. But I mean, so I'm contrasting the two. And then I think about this in the Catholic context of the Old Testament and the accidental killing prescriptions of essentially being sent to exile in one of the six refuge cities. You know, like, so thinking about that in terms of these teens, right? Who, okay, I don't think there should have been an accident is an accident, but a life, there was a life that was lost. In the Old Testament, they would have, this fellow who was the driver would have probably been sent to one of these cities of refuge per the rules of the Jewish laws at the time, right?
I don't know. I'm not so sure about that. I mean, it's accidental killing. I mean, the kid's driving along and someone falls right in front of the car. I mean, what can you do? I mean, you can't stop the car on a dime.
No, but I mean, it was more than that. It was him fleeing from this prank that they had started, you know. So he had some proximity to the cause, you know.
Yeah, but it wasn't intentional.
Certainly.
And I think this is where you also, from a Catholic perspective, we've got to make the distinction between legal and moral. Okay. Morality, Catholic morality, is always based on three principles. It's what is your object, what is the intention, and what are the circumstances? So in this, and you have to value all three of the factors in order to say this is good or bad. Legality is a different area, and sometimes they overlap, but not always. I mean, for a long time in this country, we had legal abortion. And in the minds of people, that justified it and made abortion wrong. That's not true. Morality is always
right. It made it right because it's legal. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So morality and legality don't always perfectly overlap. And morality should take priority. And we should, you know, organize our legal system to follow a solid moral structure based on natural law. So I don't know where I'm going with this.
Well, I just thought it was an interesting dichotomy, you know, because the stories were really, they happened at the same time. It was like that story came out and then my buddy told me like the next day. So.
Right. No, that is interesting.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. The Atlanta Hawks had planned to celebrate Atlanta culture with a basketball game on March 16th. That's this week. That would be a tribute to the Magic City Strip Club for its cultural contributions to the city of Atlanta. Now, Father Dan, you said you have no idea what we're talking about. I am skeptical of that. I know you've been there many times.
Oh, man.
Not okay. Really.
No comment.
The Hawks saw a huge demand spike for that night's tickets.
Okay.
San Antonio Spurs center forward Luke Kornet penned an essay about how the NBA was sanctioning the objectification of women by allowing this promotion to continue and that they needed to stop it. There was the predictable backlash to Kornet's opinion as sports pundit Michelle Beadle on her podcast told Kornet to effectively shut up and dribble as she said, quote, "We," meaning women, "don't need this. We've had enough of men telling us what we can and shouldn't want and how we should and shouldn't act." She goes on to question why the Spurs center would be shaming the stripping industry to begin with. So player Draymond Green, you know who he is?
No.
Okay, well, he's an NBA knucklehead who has accumulated over 200 career technical fouls, making him among the most penalized players in league history, while also being the second all-time leader in NBA career ejections. He came out.
That just registered 200 technical fouls.
Technical fouls.
200 technical fouls.
Yes.
Wow. It's hard to get a technical foul.
Like I said, he's a knucklehead.
Wow.
So he came out publicly praising stripping as a real art and castigated the Spurs center for his raising of an objection. So luckily, the NBA came to its senses when they heard about it and made the Hawks cancel their promotion. But you know, what does this say about the culture of today? I mean, can you imagine being parents, taking your kids to this game, like taking your 8-year-old to this game, not knowing that it's Magic City night and having to explain to them that we're honoring strippers tonight?
Chris, that's so bizarre and low that I'm kind of flabbergasted on that one.
Right here in Atlanta.
Gosh, that we would celebrate something like that. I think that's one of the reasons why ratings for NBA has gone down, because when you start allowing things, I mean, some of it's just thuggery. I don't like to watch the NBA because it's just like big men pushing each other around, and it lacks a bit of the emotion of college basketball and high school basketball. That's sick. Really sick.
Yeah. No other comment needed.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. First things contributor David Green asks, why can't conservatives create art? So the author suggests conservatives recognize progressive cultural hegemony, yet their attempts at culture making all too often amount to imitating patterns of the least progressive time they can remember. And what results is a mindset that prefers the familiar over the good. The author submits that most ordinary people think that culture was good until recently. Even if produced by liberals with questionable values, the mainstream once delivered good things that felt fun and sometimes even uplifting. That is no longer the case. The solution to the conservative mind has been to create content targeting boomers who watch cable news and middle-class millennials alienated by the recent culture shifts. He describes these products as safe retreads of political messages, bland renditions of Bible stories, and carbon copies of Hollywood genre films from the early 2000s. He says quality media should give audiences not what they say they want. It should be aspirational and show them what they should want. So I have to say that while I agree with the whole first part of what he said, the second part sounds a lot like what we've been spoon-fed over the last three decades by a liberal Hollywood that kind of wants to tell you what to think.
That knows what you should think. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's something to that. And you find that that's part of one of our rules for this show is not to be churchy, right?
Yeah.
And what is churchy? It's when you're just doling out trite, you know, pious platitudes.
Right.
And I think that there is something to creativity, and because where does creativity come from? It's participation in the creative nature of God. It's coming up with new and fresh things. I would take issue, though, with saying that there's lack of creativity within conservative circles. I mean, look at the history of art. Where's the best art stem from?
The church.
The Catholic Church. And I can't speak as much for Protestant churches, but I mean, the greatest greatest art in the history of the world, most of it is stemming from the Catholic Church.
Yeah, so when I was reading that, I was thinking, okay, well, there's a reason maybe where I were drawn sometimes to the familiar, because, you know, some of the good art of the past was, you know, pointing towards truth and truth, you know, even if that was familiar, and truth is beautiful.
Yes. Well, and this is what artists would talk about. They talk about the canon of beauty. And these are arguably things that are based in common law and the nature of reality and of humanity. And when you draw those out, there's something that we have a natural response as human beings. We gravitate towards them. When things are ugly, deformed, they don't match up to the canon of beauty, we're naturally repulsed by them. Unless you're an avant-garde, sophisticated person who's trying to prove that you've got something new and novel. I was in my flight back from Mexico the other day, and I was tired, so it's like, I'll watch a movie to relax. And I'd heard about this movie that was nominated for Best Picture and at the Academy Awards, and was, you know, got the most nominations of all time. What was it, One Battle After Another?
Okay.
I started watching the movie and I turned it off. It was horrific. I couldn't believe it. It was disgusting. I mean, I rarely will turn off a movie. I have a pretty high tolerance for violence.
If it wins the Academy Award, then that means I ain't watching it.
Well, that's kind of my point. Over the last 30 years, you look at the titles of the movies that have won the Best Picture, most of them are trash. And so the value system of those who are the critics who are trying to tell us what we should watch is really off base.
And well, think about the progression of art production over history. So when we were all farmers, right, there was no time to contemplate art. So only the wealthy and, wealthy individuals and institutions, sure, right, were supporting artists and musicians, mm-hmm, architects, right? The Catholic Church, as you mentioned, was the largest patron of the arts, sure, during the Middle Ages and the Renaissance period. And look at the incredible cathedrals and works of art that were,
that's right,
produced from those periods. Now we've transitioned to the mass media being the, quote, patron, where a corporation really is your patron.
Right.
Right. And look at what they've come up with. Like the lower barrier to entry has been this race to the bottom that always involves, you know, in some way or another, porn, violence and drugs.
Yeah.
That's where we've gone without a sort of. So I don't know what the answer here is, you know, whether we were better off when we were subsistence farming, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, that's the challenge of navigating today's life in this world.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Apparently, according to a trio of University of Pennsylvania researchers, as published in the journal Science, sexual encounters between Neanderthals and ancient Homo sapiens only happened in one direction. Genetic evidence suggests when Neanderthals and Homo sapiens interbred, the surviving lineages we see today mostly reflect Neanderthal male with human female pairings. Scientists infer this because modern humans outside of Africa carry 1-2% Neanderthal DNA in their genome. I say outside Africa because the Neanderthals were in Europe. That was, mm-hmm, where they were based.
Okay.
But Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA, which is passed only from mothers, is essentially absent in modern humans. That suggests Neanderthal mothers rarely produced lineages that survived into modern populations, while Neanderthal fathers did. So the two species likely mingled in waves of interbreeding, one about 250,000 years ago and another about 45,000 years ago. And according to the study, the mating preferences remain constant in both periods. What I want to ask you about in this finding is in relation to the weird passage in Genesis 6. You know the passage I'm talking about? When the sons of,
yes,
mm-hmm, God and the daughters of humans. So, and the origin of the Nephilim.
Mm-hmm.
If I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, you can pronounce it that way.
Okay. So the passage states that the sons of God saw how beautiful the daughters of human beings were, and so they took for their wives whomever they pleased. So I know the Thomas Aquinas view on this is that the interbreeding refers to the descendants of Seth versus the descendants of Cain.
Mm-hmm.
But what about this theory that it could possibly refer to Neanderthals? What do you think about that?
Hey, you know, I'm open to anything that makes sense. We, as Catholics, we seek the truth wherever it can be found. You know, there's many theories that will come along in science that come in the past and will come in the future that we can look at the evidence and say, does that align with the biblical record? Does it make sense? And that doesn't seem to have anything in opposition with Catholic teaching.
Well, here's what I find interesting about it. Like, let's say it was that, and this is not, I'm not saying that it is. It's just I'm just positing the question.
Sure.
But we're talking about Genesis being written in, you know, how many thousands of years ago?
Probably about 2,500 years ago.
So then that would have had to have meant that the oral traditions
handed down
from almost, you know, 45,000 years before that.
Right.
Right. That they lasted.
Which is fascinating.
It is fascinating, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's the power of oral history.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, you know, it's a testament to how oral history is can be a good thing to rely on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so,
well, it's one thing to rely on.
Yeah.
I mean, there's many other factors, archaeology and written records that provide something that's more reliable at times.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. One of my pet peeves is lack of respect for proper grammar and punctuation. It sounds like, based, mm-hmm, on what you just said, that it's also yours. But the trend is for business execs and political leaders to disregard spelling, punctuation, and proper grammar. Jack Dorsey, do you know who Jack Dorsey is?
The name rings a bell.
Founder of Twitter.
Yeah,
right. he's now the head of a financial services company called Block. So he laid off nearly half the staff last month in a memo that was entirely in lowercase. Hmm. President Trump is often spouting off on social media and features random capitalization and periodic misspellings.
Yes.
Some are saying disregarding spelling and grammar in a written conversation can be a power move. And, you know, I get that while it can be more valuable when you're thinking about speed, that it can be more valuable than the, you know, for the not worrying about the grammar when you're talking, you know, informally to your friends and maybe sure. using the letter Y instead of, you know, spelling out yes or putting the letter U for the, you know, the instead of Y-O-U. I get that. Mm-hmm. But when it's coming from a leader, particularly some kind of, you know, Jack Dorsey's official communication to employees, I call BS. There's no way. I'm sorry. That's just so poor. And it's such
a bit lowbrow.
It's lowbrow. And it's, I think it's a, you know, a symptom of a broader malaise in society. So we've developed this two-tier language system over mm-hmm. the last 10 years. And so
it reminds me a bit of the efforts years ago to instigate or to enshrine Ebonics as a language. So there's a, it's, yeah, there might be people
which is basically
who,
patois.
Well, yeah, so my people yeah. might write or speak in that way, but it doesn't yeah. mean it's cultured way of speaking or writing. So I think that's we have to look at this like, all right, what elevates the human spirit? Sinking to the lowest common denominator or rising to higher quality?
I think of this as akin to getting rid of cursive in mm-hmm. school, right?
Sure.
So moving from, it's been shown, you know, scientifically, that moving from cursive to manuscript, you know, for the sake of efficiency sure. is why we've done it. And it's really become a lost art. Like a lot of kids don't even know how to write in cursive, but mm-hmm. but they have suffered from reduced retention mm. in what they're being taught by. You retain more when you write it cursively than you do in manuscript.
Or
that's
if you just
proven.
Write it all.
Or if you just write it all.
Yes.
And so, you know, you go back to a time when many educators believed that that order in your handwriting reflected order in your mind.
Right.
And now you think about where we are with, you don't even teach cursive anymore, and you're getting, you know, from your leader of your company or your country, something that's using there instead of there. And it just drives me crazy. Like when I get an autocorrect and it's used it wrong, the wrong word.
Sure.
And I've sent it out, like I cringe.
Well, you know, and it's really easy to correct that now. All you have to do is put your, you know, chicken scratch into AI and it'll correct all your grammar for you. So it doesn't even take effort.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crosswires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens. On AM 1160, The Quest.